We remember one of South Florida's greatest leaders and pioneers, Carrie Meek. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Meek broke through barriers, among the first black people to serve in Congress since the post-Civil War Reconstruction. She fought to get millions for South Florida after disasters like hurricanes. Meek inspired her family, her constituents, and generations that followed. We'll remember her incredible life. Also, the gaming compact between Florida and the Seminole tribe is in trouble. A judge said it violates Indian gaming laws. We'll get an explainer. And finally, Miami leaders' ban on scooters was short-lived. But there's a push to make it hard to operate those devices on the street. Do they have a place in a city devoted to cars? All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. From South Florida to Washington, D.C., people are mourning the death of Carrie Meek, one of the first black people elected to represent Florida in Congress since the post-Civil War Reconstruction. She died at age 95 on Sunday after battling a long illness. Meek was the granddaughter of an enslaved woman, the daughter of sharecroppers. Her mother later owned a business. She talked about growing up around what she called, quote, the worst kind of segregation. Those memories from her childhood were present in her rise to political power. Meek was elected to Congress in 1992 and never lost a race for re-election until she retired in 2002. Her funeral and homegoing celebration will be on December 7th in Miami Gardens. Joining us now is the mayor of North Miami, Philippe Bien-Aimé, who joins us to talk about Carrie Meek's legacy. Mayor Bien-Aimé, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
I definitely appreciate your time today. And also joining us is Miami-Dade County School Board member, Dr. Dorothy Bendros-Mendingal. Dr. Bendros-Mendingal, thank you for your time.
Happy to do this presentation.
Yeah, and I wanted to start with you, Doctor. You were a mentee of Carrie Meek's. And, you know, I mean, look, people could read her biography and learn so much about her, but tell me one lasting memory that you have about her.
I'm glad you asked me. Of course, you said one lasting memory, but the mere fact that I am referred to by others as honorable is because Carrie Meek gave me that name about 2 days after I was elected for the Florida House of Representatives due to her hard work. And I have to add the hard work of her son, Kendrick Meek. So I have many memories, but I am because of her. I never dreamed of going into the arena of politics. I'm a public servant because I'm an educator. So to ask me to give you one memory, we don't have the time to give you memories, but that's one that stands out. And thank you for allowing me to do that. Thank you.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, I'm sure that there are going to be plenty of things written about her and her life and all the things that she that she did and experienced. What's what's something about her maybe that would surprise us?
Well, probably I haven't seen it written anywhere. She was a great dancer. great dancer, loved to have a good time. You could never go to her home without her having you sit down and have a meal, and the music is going. And of course, the one thing, another thing that I remember is that she had a table. I called it the table of education, and that was in the den. And she would ask me to come and sit down and give her an update. Remember, I would not have run for office if she had not voluntold me. I didn't volunteer. She told me that I was going to run. I was a principal then. Well, so when the congresswoman tells you to do something, you get to doing it. So that's not written, but that table, you sat there and you were educated. Hopefully her family and all of us will get together and put her work, the opportunity to see all that she has done and what she said to make sure that so many of us are out there serving and serving well. It's because of us sitting at that table of education that probably is not written anywhere right now, but hopefully after we get through celebrating this life for the Congresswoman, that would be something that we can put together, because many will learn from all that she has stated and, of course, written. Thank you so much.
Definitely. Mayor, to honor Congresswoman Meek, the city of North Miami has lowered all flags. What did Carrie Meek's life in public service mean to you?
Understand that our community, especially the Haitian American community here, always considered Congresswoman Carrie Meek as the mother of the community, because she wasn't fighting just for a community, but she was fighting for democracy. And you know, the Haitian American community, especially in 1991, Haiti experienced a chaotic situation when a military coup d'etat overthrew the first democratically elected president in Haiti. Whether it was in the state Senate, whether freshly elected U.S. congressman in D.C., I remember Congresswoman Carrie Meek stand from day one and fighting with the administration, with the Clinton administration, to bring back democracy in Haiti, and fighting for the immigrants and the refugees coming here because of the coup d'etat, and pressing the administration to give them a path to citizenship. And me, myself, today, I'm the mayor of the sixth largest city in Miami-Dade County, is because in 1992, between 1992 to 1998, and Congresswoman Carrie Meek been fighting for the to pass the Haitian Refugee Immigrant Fairness Act. That's give a pathway to citizenship to thousands of Haitian migrants who were in Guantanamo Bay and those coming here illegally because of the situation in Haiti. And throughout the year, since 1992 to 2000, Carrie Meek been a good advocate for the Haitian American community here, fighting with Dr. Doherty on 79 and Biscayne in front of the immigration services in order for us to be where we are today.
It sounds like that in of itself could be a book. Speaking with, again, the mayor of North Miami, Philippe Bien-Aimé, and Miami-Dade County School Board member, Dr. Dorothy Bendross-Mendenhall, we're talking about the legacy that former U.S. Representative in Congress Carrie Meek leaves behind in South Florida. The influential politician championed opportunities for Black communities. She died over the weekend at the age of 95, and you could read more about her life on social media at WLRN Sundial. Doctor, do you feel like enough people realize all that Meeks did for Miami-Dade County and South Florida? I mean, she was, you know, as I said, one of the first African Americans, one of the first Black women to serve in the Florida Senate since the 1800s. I mean, it's almost like she broke barriers at every point. I mean, do you think people understand and appreciate that?
I do. I do think they understand. She's an international woman. I told someone yesterday that she's our Shiro. She's our Harriet Tubman. She never, ever left anything undone. And she would let you know that you're going to work with me. You're going to walk with me. You're going to talk with me. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for talking about 79th Street. Those were horrific times. And to get on the back of a truck with a megaphone, which is what we did to let everyone know that we are going to fight for our Haitian brothers and sisters. They are worthy. They are deserving. I'm working with the family as I am. I've been told that they're getting calls and letters and people wanting opportunities to show their love and how much faith they had in her. And as the mayor said, being an advocate and doing all that she did, I believe in WLRN, to tell you what I've read, what I've seen, all on the national and international networks, to speak of her life. It is unheard of for someone who came through the difficult times as an African-American woman that everyone wants to know about, Congresswoman Carrie P. Davis Meek. It's unheard of. And I've known her forever, and I've worked with her on many projects, especially when I was a principal. And to say that we give her enough, I guess you would say, time and space in the media, we don't, but we're never going to stop. That's the thing that we have to do. And to you, I thank you for giving us this opportunity to share, because WLRN, and I serve on the board, I have to say that WLRN is second to none. Second to none. You will get the stories out there. You will get the news out there. You have honored many African Americans for their work, but you have not stopped since we heard of Carrie P. Meek leaving us to take her rest, and we will not stop. So, yes, we have to continue. Thank you.
No, absolutely. And thank you for that. You know, Mayor, I think about this. You know, we think about legacy and how we're going to remember her. And, you know, I think about mostly what we're teaching our kids, what we're teaching students. What do you think, you know, should be that story that we tell in classrooms? So people, you know, people know of her, of the work that she did.
One thing that people need to know about Congresswoman Carrie Meek, she wasn't advocating for African-American. She wasn't advocating for the people of Miami-Dade County. She'd been advocating for democracy, for civil rights. Yes. And with the Black Caucus, I remember Congresswoman Carrie Meek and other people like Maxine Waters, those are big advocates for democracy here for the community. And even in Haiti right now, people are talking on the radio, they're talking about Congresswoman Carrie Meek. And because in 1991, when they overthrew the first democratically elected president, and they couldn't overthrow the president, Carrie Meek stand for the with the community, fight for the community. Freshly elected to Congress, she been working with the Black Caucus, people like Randall Robinson, people like all those people in the community, the civil rights, Amnesty International, working to bring back democracy in Haiti. That's when she was an advocate for one group. She was advocate for democracy. She was advocating for civil rights. She was advocating for everything that's right for this nation.
Well, I could say that, you know, in all the years I've been doing this, I do regret the fact that I never had the opportunity to speak with her. But I get the chance to speak with folks like you to learn as much as I can about her and her legacy. And I think we see her legacy throughout. And hopefully that, you know, we fight to protect that legacy, to remind people of all that she experienced and lived and what she did as mayor, as you said, for so many communities and fighting for democracy here and abroad.
And one thing I'm glad, in 2015, here in the city of North Miami, for Women History Month, she was recognized and acknowledged for the work that she has done for this community. And I'm glad that I did that in 2015 as a council member for the city of North Miami.
I'm bringing an item to our board. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for bringing that up. To our board in this month, to recognize a day. I got this from the mayor because he recognized me not too long ago. This is Dr. Dorothy Bendross
Mendenhall. Thank you, Dr. Dorothy.
Yes, you did. And so
I have to say that now Congresswoman Carrie Meek is no longer with us. We will always remember her. And now we know we have another mother, and it was two mothers. And now we have one, Dr. Dorothy Bendross Mendenhall.
Thank you.
Advocate for the community. someone who cared for the city of North Miami and
yes, education forward.
Well, that's, you know what, to give her a day would be the least that we could do, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And, you know, absolutely. Before we finish up, Doctor, I needed to ask you because, I mean, as I'm reading her history and, I mean, the history of her family, but also, I mean, I could only just imagine it. I can't possibly understand what she might have gone through, but what did she tell you about what it was like when she was in Congress? And again, you know, I mean, again, being the first, one of the first black women in Tallahassee and one of the first black people in Congress. What was that like?
Well, she always told me that it was uphill for her, and she wore sneakers almost to the office every single day. She went in ready to fight. She went in to garner respect. They knew that she was a fighter. Well, all her life, generations prior to her, she did not want that to happen to those who were generations after her. But when she walked into the chamber, they knew that that was Carrie P. Meek, and they had to deal with her. Of course, she had some who were not as nice as they should be, or collegial, I should say, but it didn't bother her. Did not bother her. She went on a mission. She went on a mission and she worked. And we would go almost every year to what was considered the classroom. And that was brought about by the congresswoman. And we learned so much as to how to do our job, even if we were not elected. This is what you are supposed to do. This is your charge. You get back there in Miami and you do it. Even had me as an elementary school principal to bring children to Washington who were high school students. And you know, that was a little tedious, but she thought I could do it, so I did it. But it was not good. And let me just tell you this. Being that she was such a fighter, the respect that she went in, she gave everyone respect. An eloquent speaker, they had to pay attention. When she left that chamber to go to her home, she deserved the rest, R-E-S-T. She deserved it. But to know her is to love her and all that she did. And most of us are holding ourselves together because we know that she deserves the rest that she is receiving now. Yeah. Carrie P. Meek.
And you know what? We should take those sneakers, bronze them, and put them in a museum. I want to thank so much Dr. Dorothy Bendros-Mendenhall and the mayor of North Miami, Philippe Bien Aimé. Thank you so much for the time. And again, you could read more about the life of Carrie Meek on our social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, in lieu of flowers, the Meek family is requesting donations to be made to the Carrie Meek Foundation, Inc. in Opa-locka.
But she was a leader. And you know, when you become a leader, it's a little bit tougher.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I'm very pleased that you asked me that. Very tough, tough.
Thank you so much, for both of you, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Well, still to come, a judge halts the gaming compact that the governor made with the Seminoles. How does that impact your ability to make a sports bet online? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. All right, not so fast. Hold your bets. In Florida, you might soon have to say goodbye to roulette, craps, and sports betting. A federal judge is telling the state and the Seminole Tribe to tap out of their deal that expanded gambling, calling it unlawful. The deal was signed earlier this year, and it's only been about a month since the tribe started offering sports betting. And they had the monopoly on it, by the way. Joining us now to talk about this story is Mary Ellen Claus. She is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Let's start by doing this. Remind us again of the compact, this agreement between the state and the Seminole Tribe, and what we were getting and what they were getting.
Sure. Well, it's good to be here again. Thank you, Lewis. I'm always grateful to be on your show. What the governor and the legislature adopted earlier this year is a compact. It's essentially an agreement between the Seminole tribe and the state. And they did something that Florida's never had before, and that's authorized online sports betting. So anyone over the age of 21 would be allowed to start placing and betting online wagers on sporting events from college to professional sports via the internet or a sports betting app from anywhere in Florida. Now, all transactions were supposed to go through servers located on tribal land in what they call a hub and spokes model. And the tribe was also given some additional casino games, craps and roulette. And in return, the tribe was going to pay the state about $37.5 million every month, which amounts to about $2.5 billion over the first 5 years. And they would get, as you described, a monopoly over sports betting and some of these casino games.
And for that reason alone, that's why this was a historic deal, right?
Yeah, and it's specifically historic because of this sort of innovation of the hub and spokes model, where they would essentially say that all the betting is happening on tribal land because that's where the servers are, even though people were placing their bets anywhere in the state. That was very precedent setting, and that's, of course, what is now causing the issue with the legal ruling that we got last week.
Yeah, federal judge says, nope, this is unlawful. I mean, so help me understand what the judge specifically decided was why the compact broke federal law.
Well, first of all, she ruled that it violates a requirement that gambling under federal Indian gaming law must occur if there's an agreement between a state and a tribe to allow for online or to allow for gambling, that gambling has to be on tribal land. And then she also said that because the entire compact was unlawful, or because that piece was unlawful, the entire compact is unlawful. So she also invalidated the expansion of the casino games.
So how does this compact, I want to come back because I'm trying to understand this, because the federal gaming law, the Indian gaming law, says that all the gambling has to happen on their lands, but aren't the servers on their lands?
Well, so that's, I think, what we're going to see play out as this legal contest heads through the appellate process. Judge Frederick essentially said that although the compact said that all sports betting will occur at the location of the tribe servers, she also said, just because you say it's true doesn't make it a fact. she concluded that bets placed outside of the tribal land, and the tribe has agreed, for example, to set up sports betting kiosks at paramutual facilities that have agreed to have a partnership where they'd get a cut of every sports bet placed. People could download an app on their phone and they could be sitting on their couch or anywhere, as long as they're in the state, and place a bet. And she said, that's not tribal land.
So obviously the Seminole saying, look, if we shut this down now, I mean, this is going to cost us a lot of money. At least let us keep doing the online betting until this keeps moving through the courts. But what did the judge say to that?
Well, here's the dynamic that is kind of puts everything in legal limbo. The judge says they're operating illegally. And she disagreed that, she said that even though the tribe may be saying this has economic harm, and they cited all kinds of reasons, they suggested they have, invested a lot of money already in building this sports betting operation. They would lose substantial revenue. They're about to launch their roulette and craps operations in their casinos and hired, hundreds of additional employees and have vendors on the hook for obligations. She said, while that may hurt the tribe's economic interest, there is also another harm that's happening to the existing plaintiffs who have filed this lawsuit. And that is the West Flagler Associates, who are the owners of Magic City Casino and the Bonita Springs Poker Room. And their argument was, as soon as the online betting app launched, they lost money. And the longer this operates illegally in their mind, the more they're losing. So the judge said, you know, it's a balancing act. You know, who should be the one continuing to face the harm as this operation continues? So she has not imposed any kind of sanctions or enforced this violation that she has issued. She's ruled it as unlawful, but they're still operating. So that is where the questions arise. Does the U.S. attorney come in and halt the gaming operations? Does the National Indian Gaming Commission come in and impose some restrictions? Who's going to police this? Mm. Or does the judge order them back into court? That's the big unknown right now.
Yeah. Have we heard from the governor or his office what the response is to this judge's decision?
The governor's office has taken a very interesting position, in my view. I mean, they have basically said, we were not a party to this lawsuit. We don't really have anything to do with it. And so, you know, it is what it is. Now, the governor has indicated that he acknowledged that it was sort of uncharted legal territory when they created this hub and spokes model. So he knew that this might be a gamble, literally. However, the idea that the governor was not instrumental in negotiating this and allowing it to become law, sort of, it the fact that he says they're not a party is actually not a fact, because it was his signature on this compact that allowed this whole process to happen and go into motion.
Again, I'm talking with Mary Ellen Claus, Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about the gambling compact that the Seminole Tribe has with the state of Florida to bring roulette, craps, and sports betting online to the state. And again, the state gets a lot of money from the tribe for this every month, but it could be short-lived because the federal judge, again, ruled it unlawful. So what is the future of this deal? You can find more, by the way, of Mary Ellen's story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. So wait a second. So I understand this. You said this. They're still taking bets online. I could still go online and make a bet with the Seminole Tribe.
That's my understanding, that their app is still operating.
And so does that mean the state is still getting money? Because again, as you said, this is millions of dollars a month.
Right. Well, the state, you know, the tribe has said it's already paid the state about $75 million for 2 months of operation. So yes, it doesn't appear as if the state is losing out on the revenue sharing piece of this deal at this point. There has been an appeal. The tribe has asked an appellate court to look at this, and the appellate court gave them until noon today to file their response briefs. And that has been interesting. It looks like the federal government is basically saying, well, you know, we agree that we don't agree with the tribe's analysis for why they want to put a halt to this ruling or why they want to stay the ruling pending appeal. But we also don't oppose it. So they've kind of taken a weird kind of hands-off approach. And then the tribe is arguing, you know, all the economic harm that this has done, and disagreeing with the logic of the district court judge, and is making the argument that the appellate court should reverse it.
And, you know, the other thing, too, is that the federal judge suggested that the tribe and the Department of Interior approve a new compact. I mean, what are the chances of that happening?
So technically, while the if this compact has been invalidated, the old compact is in force. So the tribe can continue to operate the games that it had absent the roulette, craps, and sports betting. So they can continue to operate that. But if they want any of these new games, they got to start over. That's what the judge said. And the way they start over is they make it legal first in Florida, and then they can expand it. So because the voters approved a constitutional amendment that said there can be no expansion of gambling unless it goes through a voter approved initiative or referendum. There's two ways to get to that. They can either put an initiative on the ballot that asks voters to approve it, or the legislature can put an initiative on the ballot. And whether that happens, I think will depend on where these appeals go. The legislature meets in January and will be in session until March. They have shown, as they did last session, that if they want to pass something quickly relating to gaming, they can, even though it's taken, you know, in the past, it's taken years for us to get a resolution. With this governor and this legislature, it appears that that mindset has shifted. So if the appellate court upholds the district court's opinion and says that this gaming is indeed illegal, then the legislature is going to have to step in, I think, and respond.
The other thing I was thinking too is, because you had mentioned it, you know, they'd set up the roulette and the craps games, and now they have to stop that.
It's my understanding that they hadn't quite launched that. They'd hired some staff and they needed to train people, and they hired all the, you know, the games and themselves. They've purchased everything and made a pretty big investment, but they were about to launch it. They said in their motion, sometime in the next month.
So as you said, this is, you know, it's up to the appellate court or the legislature at this point. If I'm a betting man, Mary Ellen, what do you think, which way is this going?
You know, I don't have a good idea. I really think that this is online sports betting. We're in a new era where the internet is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, you know, the argument that the tribe should be able to operate without sort of the fences of an artificial tribal territory is one that will establish all kinds of new precedent. And it's probably a good thing that this is being challenged and has to go back and forth. I really don't know where this is going to end up. I think that if you just read the black and white of where we are in federal gaming law, it seems pretty clear that tribal land means physical tribal land.
Right.
And they tried to get around it by establishing this server model, and it was a big question. Until those things change, it may not, we may see that they have to rewrite the law.
Yeah.
To make it work.
The story that we're going to keep following, because it's big money for the state, and also the question of the future of gambling in the state as well. Mary Ellen Claus, Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times. Check out her reporting on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mary Ellen, thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
And by the way, we want to hear from you. What do you think about this? You know, and if it goes up to a vote for you, what do you think? That you would vote for the compact? You would perhaps vote for expansion of gambling in the state of Florida? Is that a good idea? Is that where we should go? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or join our text club, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. I want to hear your thoughts on this. Still to come, you may have seen scooters once again zooming through Miami, but what's in the future for those two-wheel transports? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Miami City leaders are allowing, for now, these e-scooters on some streets. In an emergency meeting yesterday, the City Commission decided to overturn an earlier ban on the scooters, but with more restrictions. Well, joining us now to discuss the debate over the scooters and their future in Miami is Miami Herald reporter Joey Fletches. Joey, all right, so I started to see a lot more of these scooters around today, but remind us why they were canceled in Miami in the first place. All right, so we're going to try to get him connected. Just want to remind folks again that what happened was the city of Miami again had banned, not permanently, temporarily banned e-scooters on streets, but yesterday early in the morning they had an emergency meeting to decide to let them back out again, but with restrictions. There are going to be restrictions as to how many can be parked in a particular area. There were conversations about possibly making people wear helmets when they ride them, and how many different companies would be able to have scooters in Miami streets. And I'd love to hear from you on this, if you're someone who uses the scooters. Again, you can find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Do you use them? And, you know, what's your take? What's your take on having scooters around the street? Maybe you're a motorist or a cyclist or a pedestrian. You know, what are your thoughts? Again, find us at WLRN Sundial. Let us know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And we're going to try to reach out to the city as well, because I'd love to hear their thoughts on the future of scooters in the streets. And then we're trying to get Miami Herald's Joey Fletches back on the line. Is he there, Joey?
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Hey, Joey. Great to have you. All right, Joey, this emergency meeting yesterday. First of all, remind me, why were the scooters canceled in Miami?
So there was, there have been a few commissioners for more than a year now who have just disapproved of the scooter program. And they feel that this is an accident waiting to happen. They think there's a lot of danger with, you know, electric scooters being ridden on the street and on sidewalks. Quality of life concerns for pedestrians trying to enjoy their park space and scooters kind of zooming by. Manolo Reyes and Joe Carollo, two commissioners who have kind of been adamantly against this program since the beginning. But what changed in the past few weeks was Commissioner Alex Diaz-Laportilla, who had in the past voted to extend this scooter program and allow scooters on downtown streets and Brickell streets. Before Thanksgiving, he decided that he wanted to end the program in its you know, form at that time, and then came back and said, called a meeting for yesterday with the mayor. The mayor called a meeting, and he sponsored Diaz-Laportilla sponsored a legislation to bring the program back with some more safety measures to kind of assuage some of the concerns that some of the other commissioners have, including requiring helmets, limiting speed, limiting hours of operations, things like that.
Was it just these commissioners, or who else in the community was calling for the removal of scooters?
This is a strong contingent of folks who live downtown, folks who live along Biscayne Boulevard near Bayfront Park and Maurice Ferre Park, who have, you know, told stories about, you know, family members being knocked over by a kid on a scooter zooming by too fast. And it's a big complaint is that scooters are not supposed to be used by minors, and they are. And parents are basically renting out these scooters using their driver's licenses and their mobile apps, and then giving it to their young children. Who, you know, might not be the most coordinated, or might be zooming through a park that someone's trying to go through, stroll through. So,
and to be clear, I mean, like, to get one of these scooters, I mean, that's basically like you have to have the app from the company, and then you just scan in that you want to rent it for a certain amount of time or mileage or whatever, right?
Right. Yeah. You have to actually scan your driver's license, and you know, there's a rate for, you know, the for that you agree to, and then you're able to use it. And that's when remotely the company unlocks the scooter so you could actually use it. And some of those requirements there are new requirements now under this new program that just restarted. They're going to make it even, you know, more difficult to activate one of these scooters. There's going to be, and some companies talked yesterday about actually a verification system where you have to take a picture of yourself wearing a helmet and submit that to the app before the scooter can be unlocked. as a way, as a means of verifying that, you know, the rider is wearing a helmet. Other companies are not able to do that as quickly necessarily, but the idea still will be that, you know, the parking authority and police will actually enforce the wearing of helmets on scooters now.
So I've got a lot of questions about these new restrictions. Again, talking with Miami Herald reporter who covers the city of Miami, Joey Fletches, talking about this debate over scooters in the city. And you can follow us on social media at WLRN Sundial. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. If you are a scooter user, you know, tell us your thoughts. What, you know, how important is it to have them? But, you know, what do you think about these restrictions? So let's see. It was some of the stuff that I'd read. Again, let's talk about the helmets. So they're not asking the companies to provide helmets, but you have to show proof that you're wearing one. I mean, look, I'm not the techie guy here, but can't I fake that photo? I mean, you know, can I fake a photo of myself wearing a helmet or what?
I think you could. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's limitations to the amount of, you know, the, how much you can really rely on a verification system like that, to ensure that a rider for the duration of an entire, you know, period, rental period is wearing a helmet. On the other hand, if, you know, the city's police, you know, have a right to sort of stop you and say, listen, you can't continue to ride this because you're supposed to wear a helmet. Or, you know, parking authority officials who have traditionally been the enforcement agency for rules around scooters. That's another layer of, you know, patrolling and enforcement that occurs. But yeah, I mean, in theory, you know, if I'm where I am right now in Coconut Grove, and I wanted to ride through this park and on a scooter, and if, you know, I, you know, put a helmet on and then decided I was going to just not take it off when I took off, I suppose you could do that. But you're right. The companies are not required to provide the helmet. You can bring your own. So it does raise questions about how strict of enforcement they can actually pull off here.
Is there an effort to reduce the number of companies that provide these scooters, which is what, like 4 or 5 of them?
Yeah, right now, there are currently 7 operating.
Oh, 7. Okay.
There's a bunch. Yeah. And, you know, there are more than 1,000 scooters that can be put into operation on the streets right now under the program, the temporary program, which is not that temporary. It's actually been around for a few years. But yes, there is an effort to reduce that number to 3. And that is because the city, and part of the debate yesterday was that the city is right now processing an open bid that allowed companies to, you know, submit their proposals to be the permanent vendors for electric scooters in the city of Miami. There are 3 companies eventually that the city will choose and give, you know, licenses to operate on the streets. That, so the number will go down. That process might not play out very, very soon. It might play out like in the first quarter of next year.
I see. And what about the issue with underage usage? How can they stop that?
Enforcement is, I think, the only tool they have. You know, they have the license requirement, but like I said, you can get around that, right? You could scan your kid, you know, you can scan your driver's license and put your kid on a scooter. But a way for them to, you know, to potentially discourage that kind of activity is to actually fine the company for allowing that kind of use. The companies under the current rules right now do have a right to pass that fine on to the user. So that does exist. I don't have information right now available on what the number of fines have been. But that is right now the strongest tool that they have to prevent, you know, minors from riding these. And that's an argument that the residents downtown make. They say, how could you possibly put all these rules on there and really truly enforce them? I'm still going to get, you know, my feet run over by, you know, a 10-year-old on a scooter. That is really the argument that a lot of folks who live in these areas and use these parks are making when they're arguing against the scooters.
I see. What the other couple things that were discussed were having only 2 scooters parked in the same place at the same time, and also the time that you could use one was also changed, correct?
That's right. Yeah. Before yesterday's vote, the scooters were, you could activate a scooter until about midnight. Midnight, the vendors would come around and they would load up on and pick them up and, you know, replace them in different spots. Now the cutoff time is 9 p.m. So that would reduce the number of scooters that are on the streets at night. And you're right. So for each block face, the number of scooters that are allowed to be parked there are only two, as opposed to two per vendor. So mentioned seven vendors earlier, right? So 14. But it used to be four. So that's where another complaint from people came from, which was the clutter, you know, these that they're lying around everywhere. They're being knocked over. The wind blows and knock them over. And then you see just a bunch of scooters strewn about.
I've seen piles of them. I have. You know, I mean, was there any discussion, Joey, about, look, we have like the worst streets for scooters, for cyclists, for pedestrians. We're not built for that. We're built for cars. I mean, were there any discussions about, well, maybe we need to just restructure, you know, our roads first before we decide to debate any other wheels?
The discussion comes from both sides of the argument. You know, the folks who are against this will say, we need to provide the infrastructure first, right? We need to have protected bike lanes before you put scooters on the street so that you can ensure, to the best extent possible, people will be safe while they're on these, and they'll be safe from, you know, accidents with vehicles. Now, to be fair, a statistic I do have that I got when I was talking to some public safety officials at City Hall yesterday was there's no record of any scooter versus car accident under this program to date. Been in place since 2019. So far, no scooter versus car accident has occurred that's, you know, been recorded by police. So something to think about. And now that leads to another issue about people riding them on sidewalks. But as far as your question about infrastructure, another thing that the scooter program has yielded for the city is a little more than $2 million worth of revenue, registration fees, and these companies needing to pay to have the licenses they need and permits they need to work. And with some of that money, there have already been bicycle lanes constructed, a lane on Bird Road inside the district where these scooters are allowed, which is District 2. Also, a city-county split project in downtown that is not finished yet, but bike lanes are being added. So it's something that both sides consider when they talk about it.
I mean, I don't know, Joey, have you seen a city anywhere, or is the mayor ever, because I know he's traveling around and you know, trying to turn Miami into a tech hub. I mean, can he point to a city that says, hey, look, they figured it out. They found a way to make it all work.
There are definitely advocates, and among the advocates are, you know, Mayor Francis Suarez, Commissioner Ken Russell, who's championed this program, who point to other areas. I'm not recalling immediately which specific cities are pointed to as success stories, but broadly speaking, they have some policies have been mentioned, which include, for example, the verification process for you know, reducing the number of minors, or helmet wearing, or even more infrastructure like not making them dockless. Part of the appeal is that you can kind of leave them anywhere and pick them up anywhere. But you know, there's conversation about perhaps like creating a little bit more of an organized, you know, corralling system so that they're not actually strewn about. So there are concepts that have been pulled from other places that some advocates have championed. And so part of that is the conversation as they create a permanent program come next year.
Mm. It's not a story that's going away anytime soon. So I want to thank Joey Fletchus of the Miami Herald covering this story. And you can read more about his reporting on this, on the scooters and the debate in City Hall, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Joey, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, we've been hearing from you. We're, you know, on social media, JBC Trader on Twitter said, it's sad that the government even has a say in this matter. Someone else on Twitter posted, I hate these things, the scooters. I got into an accident because of them. Idiots drive them worse than their cars. Somebody else on Twitter said, the two scooters on each block does not make sense at the FTX arena. This is someone who wants more scooters. I will say this, I don't have a problem with scooters, but I have to admit, it was just a few weeks ago, I probably would have killed two people on scooters. Two women on scooters, I had the green light, and they zipped right in front of me. Folks, whether you're on a bike, on a scooter, on these electric scooters, we all have to follow the rules of the road. And I missed them by feet, just a few feet. I would have smashed into them. You know, all of us, please follow the rules of the road, because if not, there will be an accident. That's my public service announcement for today. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, the last day of November 2021. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk with one Miami artist you won't see up in a tent at Art Basel, but her art will blow you away. She's on the streets painting portraits of people who are experiencing homelessness in Miami. We talk with her about why she feels such a deep connection to the people that she paints. And former Miami Herald film critic Renee Rodriguez, now working at the University of Miami, talking about film. He's also the new manager of the acclaimed Bill Cosford Cinema. We're going to talk about movies with him, a real fun conversation. All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. Remember, you can always listen to the rebroadcast of the program at 8 o'clock tonight or find us on your podcast app. We are a podcast, WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.